and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, 9 months after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, the island's government has moved to privatize and upgrade its outdated electrical grid. Next, Sara Netanyahu, the wife of Israel's prime minister, was charged today with felony counts of fraud and breach of trust. She's accused of spending more than $100,000 on meals at the prime minister's residence and $10,000 on private chefs for herself. The charges carry a maximum sentence of 8 years in prison. Then, an East Pittsburgh police officer is being accused of shooting and killing 17-year-old Antoine Rose after the youth fled a car the officer had pulled over. Video of the incident shows Rose being shot in the back. He was unarmed. Protests against police violence continued in Pittsburgh today. And then Church and State, The Israel Experiment, is an upcoming film by Netra Halperin, a Hollywood producer and director with a concern for peace and equality. The filmmaker joins us in the studio to talk about it. And finally, 1 year after Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud was elevated to Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, as well as defense minister, his war in Yemen rages on, while MBS, as he's known in the West, maintains an ongoing charm offensive here. His policies threaten the lives of millions of Yemenis, at least 8 million of whom are currently at risk of starvation. And all of that is in the name of curbing Iranian influence in the region. That and more is coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Puerto Rico. 9 months after Hurricane Maria devastated the island, Puerto Rico's government has moved to privatize and upgrade its outdated electrical grid. We're joined from Kalamazoo, Michigan, by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She's associate professor and chair of the Anthropology and Sociology Department at Kalamazoo College. And we're also joined from Mayagüez by Fredison Martinez, the vice president of UTIER, or the Electrical Industry and Irrigation Workers Union, which represents workers with the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Saludos.
Fredison, let's start with you. Tell us if this is a good thing for Puerto Rico or a bad thing.
Well, we have stated from the beginning that privatization of the PREPA, Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, it's a great mistake. It's a great mistake. You know, it's been justified under false premises, you know, and we have proved to the government, to the legislators, the senators and the representatives, that they are using bad metrics to do what they intend to do. The privatization of the electric grid of Puerto Rico. We have the system in Puerto Rico. It is a centralized one because we are an island. We are not in the states where we have a lot of states and we can have electric connections with other states. Here in Puerto Rico, we are isolated. We depend only on the production that is generated here in Puerto Rico. That also It's a part of the equation that hasn't been measured by the promoters of privatization, because by the industry standards, PREPA has to have about a reserve equal to the biggest unit, the biggest generation unit that PREPA has. So the company has to, for example, has to have available 450 megawatts without using them, because they have to be available if one of the big plants fail. But recently in Puerto Rico, that has not been a problem because there have not been plants failing. It's been the whole system for two times have collapsed by the mistakes made by the contractors that have been hired by the government of Puerto Rico and the Corps of Engineers. But we have stated that based on the economic numbers and estimates made by the Puerto Rico government agencies, that the plan that they have to privatize PREPA will only raise the rates for the people of Puerto Rico.
Adriana Garriga-Lopez, this sounds like What Freddie Sun is describing sounds like shock capitalism, that the big corporations and the big banks move into a place like Puerto Rico that has just gone through a disaster because they know they can get things for pennies on the dollar. People would probably welcome them because what they have now has failed. And then in the end, they get rich and the people of Puerto Rico suffer. Is that right? Is that what we're seeing here?
Yeah, I think that's a fair appraisal when you talk about disaster capitalism and corporations preying on situations that have resulted from natural disasters or other kinds of disasters. But I think that it's also a continuation of a longstanding history of abuse and colonialism in Puerto Rico, and it cannot be separated from that history. And I think with regards to the electricity grid, the larger question has to be one of accountability. And in terms of privatization or any kind of public-private partnership, Puerto Rico becomes a captive market for U.S. energy corporations that can feel very secure that there's going to be government support for their endeavors in Puerto Rico. So, you know, under the context or in the context of colonialism and a lack of democratic representation for Puerto Ricans, it's very worrisome that private companies could come in and divide up the grid and basically do whatever they want with a grid that continues to be just as vulnerable to any future storms because it has the reconstruction that has taken place or the privatization that has taken place is not being done under the aegis of any kind of sustainability of that grid or of accountability to people, for example, in the mountains or in the most isolated towns. And there's not a lot of incentive for private corporations to address the needs of poor residents or people that are trying to reconstruct destroyed areas in the mountains. So those are the kinds of things that I think are important to consider, as well as considering the ways in which this reproduces the disaster capitalism or the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein has talked about, others have talked about, that takes place sort of regularly after disasters take place in different places.
Fredison Martinez is also with us. He's the vice president of the workers at the Electrical Industry and Irrigation Workers Union, which represents the workers with the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority. It seems, Fredison, that in many ways this was, you could see this one coming, that there was almost a feeling of deliberateness and perhaps glee or happiness whenever there was a blackout, because it would prove once again that the existing publicly owned electric system wasn't working. And it almost felt like some people, some powerful people wanted it to fail. Anyway, you're representing the workers. How do the workers think about that?
Well, we're pretty sure that there are no casualties in what has been happening here in Puerto Rico. For a long time, the different governments have insisted on privatization of the Puerto Rico electric grid based on the system has failed. But of course it has failed because the government has not funded it to make the repairs, the maintenance needed to improve the system. So like you said, we saw it coming. We have seen for a long time this coming. But we also feel that the governor of Puerto Rico showed a lot of insensibility by announcing on January, when there were about like more than a million people without power, announcing the privatization of PREPA, like if that was the great news, that the other day the people were going to have power because PREPA is going to be privatized and that. But still, there have been 5 months after the announcement of the proposed privatization of PREPA, and we have still more than 10,000 customers without power. The government and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have spent close to $3 billion on the contracts, and still we have people without power. And we're very critical of that, because with that amount of money, you can bet that you can contract or you can hire more workers for the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, give the workers the equipment they need, the vehicles they need, the materials they need so they can make the work that the people of Puerto Rico, we need here to be done. And that's been appointed by the informed that was made public yesterday by the Congress about the delay of the Puerto Rican government in contacting the American Public Power Association and the late reaction of the government in all respects. Well, we're talking about the electric here, but in all respects to the slow response of the government to the crisis that was created by Juan María Solanos, but also by the slowness and the insensibility of the government to attend this crisis. So we have been very critic. Our workers are very aware of the consequences of the proposed privatization, and we're ready to fight against that, to inform the people of Puerto Rico the facts of the privatization, so the people can be in a position to know the truth, that the government are not telling the facts about the privatization of PREPA, and that way the people can be in a position to determine what's the better option for the Puerto Rico electric grid, that we are pretty sure that it is not the privatization of the system.
Well, let me ask Dr. Garriga Lopez about an article that she contributed to in Counterpunch entitled "The Cruelest Storm, A Statement for Puerto Rico." You start off by saying the destruction brought by Hurricane Maria has exposed the profound colonial condition of Puerto Rico as millions of human beings are faced with a life or death situation. Puerto Ricans are American citizens, for better or for worse. Can you imagine any other scenario here in the continental U.S. or Alaska or Hawaii where, after a natural disaster, those American citizens were treated the way Puerto Ricans have been treated since Hurricane Maria?
There are actually some comparative examples that you could point to in terms of marginalized populations within the United States and in the other unincorporated territories of the United States. If we talk, for example, about the U.S. Virgin Islands, who also suffered as a result of Hurricane Maria, we would have to admit that Puerto Rico is not alone, actually, neither in its colonial condition nor in its vulnerability to the neglect that it suffered at the hands of the United States after Maria. And I agree that there's no one that knows the Puerto Rican electricity grid better than the Puerto Rican workers. And it's been something that has been remarked upon in the media repeatedly, that U.S. crews that went to Puerto Rico were surprised at the conditions that Puerto Ricans were working under in terms of the electrical work and at the kinds of skills that they had to have to be able to work with it. So one of the ways that history of colonialism is manifest today still, not only politically, is also in terms of the idea of the capability of Puerto Ricans and what Puerto Ricans are capable of, whether that is self-government or whether that is the management of our own resources or whether that is the abilities of workers to do complicated tasks like rebuilding this electricity grid. So I think, you know, there are comparative scenarios. And when you look at Katrina, I think there are lessons to be learned by Puerto Ricans in resistance to privatization, also from activists in Katrina. I know that folks are making those connections and working those activist networks as well.
Well, certainly one of the things that happened after Hurricane Katrina, again, along the lines of what might be called shock capitalism or, you know, certain powerful political and economic forces taking advantage of a natural disaster, partly to carry out ethnic cleansing or gentrification or takeover of what's considered to be prime real estate. Certainly that happened in the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. Freddison, are the people there on the island, are people, we know that there's been a lot of emigration as a consequence of all of this hardship where people are leaving and coming, say, to the mainland of the United States. Do people feel that this is part of a sort of a scaled up gentrification where there's actually a desire to have some parts of the Puerto Rican population leave the island so that other people can come and take control of it?
Yeah, we have 100% sure about that. We have seen a lot of people, running out of Puerto Rico because we feel that the government is making, you know, the politics that they are making are just to make the people run away, because there has been laws that have been passed that make the living, the working conditions, for example, for the private workers, very difficult. You know, the wages every day are lower, the cost of living is higher. When you make that equation, you know, the people have to live on credit cards, on loans, to survive here in Puerto Rico, and that's no way that that people can survive. So we're pretty sure about that, including the two islands, the two municipalities of Vieques and Culebra. The people in those islands still have no power. They are the power that they have is by diesel generated plants that have been hired by the Corps of Engineers, and those plants are part of a contract that goes to close to $30 million monthly of diesel on those two islands and other power generation plants around the island. You know, it goes to $30 million monthly. And we think that the Puerto Rican government is going to keep those plants there. Later, they're going to charge the people of Vieques and Culebra the real cost of the production of light there with diesel, but it's going to be a lot higher. The people, they're going to see that, well, we can pay these bills and more. So they leave the island, and then there goes the people that have the money, millionaires, to live in that condition, because those two islands are, you know, I don't know if you know about those islands, but they are more part of the most beautiful places of Puerto Rico.
I know that it really is. We're almost out of time. We have 1 minute left, Adriana. What's the core message? We're broadcast here in Washington D.C. today, as we are every day Monday through Friday, and then other stations throughout the mainland of the United States. What's the main message that people who don't know much about what's going on in Puerto Rico? What's the main message that you want to send them?
I think the main message that has to be sent at this point is the need for decolonization. Puerto Rico needs to be decolonized. There was many people that presented at the United Nations this week before the UN Decolonization Committee. And once again, the United Nations has called for a process of decolonization for Puerto Rico that is long overdue. And so the main goal here has to be broader than simply rebuilding what was there before Maria. It has to be broader than even resisting the process of disaster capitalism. It really is about self-determination, and that it is high time for Puerto Ricans to have access to the fundamental right to self-determination.
The most important thing, self-determination.
We were joined from Kalamazoo, Michigan, by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She's associate professor and chair of the Anthropology and Sociology Department at Kalamazoo College. And we were joined from Mayagüez by Fredison Martinez, the vice president of UTIER, or the Electrical Industry and Irrigation Workers Union, which represents workers with the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Sara Netanyahu, the wife of Israel's prime minister, was charged today with felony counts of fraud and breach of trust. She's accused of spending more than $100,000 on meals at the prime minister's residence and $10,000 on private chefs for herself. The charges carry a maximum sentence of 8 years in prison. We're joined from Jerusalem by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be with you guys.
Miko, tell us about this case, these charges, and just how dangerous this is for Sara Netanyahu.
It's a little bit hard to say, because when you look at the charges and when you look at the amounts of money that we're talking about, relatively speaking, it's really not that much money. In other words, it's not like she stole millions and millions of dollars or you know, was found with some kind of a Swiss bank account or an offshore bank account with millions of dollars. We're talking about small-time corruption. And, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I can't imagine Netanyahu being hurt by this just because he is so strong politically. He's done so much. He's probably achieved more as an Israeli prime minister in terms of getting things, getting support from the U.S., you know, the Jerusalem Declaration, the Iran deal. These are all victories that he single-handedly brought home. And I can't imagine the small-time corruption case against his wife is going to make a big difference. Of course, you never know. I mean, who knows? It might. But I just can't imagine with the political atmosphere here and the discourse here right now. I mean, I'm in Jerusalem right now. Israel is winning so big on every front, getting away with so much on every front. And in many ways, it's a lot of it has to do with him being at the helm. You know, he can do all these terrible things and get away with it. And so I can't imagine anybody would want to hurt him politically, other than a few other people who want his seat. But it's you know, I really don't think this is going to make much of a difference. Of course, I may be wrong, but I don't think so.
Let's expand the conversation then. You're joining us from a hotel in Jerusalem. Today, the White House said that that Jared Kushner is on his way back to the Middle East to unveil a new peace plan that probably will be rejected immediately by the Palestinians. What's the mood like in Jerusalem? And is anybody taking Jared Kushner and his ideas seriously?
No. The atmosphere is horrifying, not just in Jerusalem, but everywhere. I mean, I'm sitting here at the Jerusalem Hotel, which is a kind of a landmark small hotel right across the street, pretty much, from the old city of Jerusalem. It's a distinctly Palestinian hotel. It's been owned by the same family since, I mean, it's been over here since 1950. It's been owned by the same family since 1960. They just tried to hold like an iftar dinner with some business people and journalists and, you know, the police, and the secret police came, raided the place, kicked everybody out. I mean, the guy was, you know, he spent a lot of money putting it together. Boom, all done, gone. They're trying to kick out tourists that come to stay here and eat at the restaurant. It's a lovely little kind of a air garden restaurant. You know, the harassment is unending. You know, and this is an important landmark hotel. It's small, but it's a landmark. Yesterday, I was visiting with friends. Munda Amira from the camp near Bethlehem, Aida refugee camp. He just got out of 6 months. You know, he's a very well-known activist here. And he was in prison for 6 months. He was urinating blood the entire time. Nobody ever thought to take him to a doctor or a hospital. He lost, I don't know how, half of his weight. He looks horrible, you know, he's a young guy. Bassem Tamimi, I spent the night with him last night. We were at his house, you know, his wife and his daughter and his older son are all in jail. You know, but Nabi Saleh, the village where he's from, you know, the settlers cut down all of their olive trees. And the settlement, Halamish, which is across the street and has, you know, access to all the water they want, are growing these beautiful olive trees. You know, they've got these rows and rows and rows of olive trees that they're growing. I mean, the Israelis are winning here at every front. Another Palestinian kid, also Tamimi family, from a village near Nabi Saleh, Din Nizam. I think he's 15 years old, and he had some kind of a protein deficiency, and they didn't get the medicine to him in jail on time. He's been in prison, and he just lost his eyesight. I mean, we're talking about little, you know, individual cases that are just never ending. And then, of course, we have Gaza, the Gaza Strip, which is an hour's drive from here. We all know all the people that were murdered by the Israelis, the thousands and thousands who were injured. Horrifying conditions, and nobody cares. There's a siege going on. There's no clean water. 2 million people. The hospitals are full of children with kidney failure. There are more children with kidney failure, Palestinian children with kidney failure from Gaza in one hospital here than all the kidney failure cases in Israel. In other words, it doesn't happen because when there's clean access to clean water, your kids don't get, there's no kidney failure. It only happens because of there's a lack of access to water. So you've got children who need dialysis. I mean, we're talking about a horrendous reality. Besides the bombing and the killing and the shooting that we see on a daily basis, we're talking about the torture and killing of people in so many different ways. The killing of businesses, the harassment of children, and the harassment of prisoners, political prisoners, denying people water and on and on and on. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to talk about it. And like I said, Netanyahu is getting away with everything. And he's leading this country in a way that everybody feels here on the Israeli side is really good because they're winning on every front. But it's horrifying because the vast majority of the population here are not Israeli Jews. They're Palestinians. And they are living in terrible, terrible racist, racist discrimination.
Miko, is there any political reason why the Israeli government would want a formal peace treaty with the Palestinians?
Absolutely not. There's no reason for them. They don't want one. They're not. They will not do anything to get a peace treaty. These trips by Jared Kushner are probably to iron out details of some kind of a deal between the Saudi crown prince and Netanyahu and Trump. I mean, that's probably what it's all about. It's not anything anybody takes seriously. I don't think it's anything that can be implemented. You know, they call it, I think, the deal of the decade or the deal of the century or whatever. It's not a deal, and it's got no potential, and I don't think anybody's taking it seriously, and there's no sense of hope whatsoever. There's really no sense of hope whatsoever.
That's the voice of Miko Peled. We're talking to him from Jerusalem. He's at the Jerusalem Hotel, a Palestinian-owned hotel. That hotel itself was victimized by a police raid when it tried to have an event there. Miko is the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko's new book is Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, if I'm not mistaken, you were born in Jerusalem. Your father was an important general in the Israeli army. When you look back at Jerusalem now in 2018 from the Jerusalem you were aware of as a child, what's the big difference?
Well, the difference to me personally is that as a child, I never had access. Going into the Palestinian side of the city was not something you did. You know, it was dangerous, and you know, because they're Arabs and so forth. So, I mean, we would go for a little walk in the old city, but only where it's safe and only where there's Jews and so forth. Today, I have access. I go everywhere. And so I'm aware of the reality here for Palestinians. And in terms of the biggest change is probably the de-Arabizing of the city, of East Jerusalem, which was predominantly Arab. You know, there's the massive building of Jewish neighborhoods for Jews only at the expense of Palestinians. There's the squeezing of Palestinian businesses to the point where they, you know, I'm sure the plan is to force them to close down by creating conditions that are unfavorable, that make it impossible to keep businesses. The stores in the old city, I mean, you see them closing like at 3 p.m. because the Israeli tour guides tell the tourists not to buy from the Arabs, only to buy from the Jews. So even though you see thousands of people on the streets, the shops are closing down because nobody's buying. So, I mean, in terms of the push of the to Judaize, what they call it, to Judaize, the old city in East Jerusalem, it's completely changed the landscape here.
You know, I don't think most Americans are aware of this day-to-day racism that Miko's talking about, that he sees while he's there. It's just never reported. It's never discussed.
It's the opposite. It's the Palestinians who are the great tormentors of Israelis.
Right.
I mean, that's the basic bottom line narrative.
Yeah, that's it.
We talk a lot, you know, on your show and things in shows like this, but people don't want to, you know, people don't want to discuss it. People don't want to hear it. And again, if you're not talking about hundreds of people dying or some, you know, real big violent outburst, people are not interested in the small details. And the small details are really what make life impossible. They're what push the racism. They're what, you know, the expression of the racism is in no access to water, no access to business, no access to customers, not allowing customers to park or loading zone for you know, a restaurant to get their slides. And over years, people just have to close down. They have no choice. You know, so there's only so much you can maintain to maintain a business with all these difficult conditions, plus paying enormous taxes. Especially in Jerusalem, the Palestinian businesses pay enormous taxes and fines on every little thing.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Jerusalem by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
An East Pittsburgh police officer is being accused of shooting and killing 17-year-old Antoine Rose after the youth fled a car the officer had pulled over. Video of the incident shows Rose being shot in the back three times. He was unarmed. Protests against police violence continued in Pittsburgh today. We're joined in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek.
Walter, you are from Pittsburgh, and John, you're from Pittsburgh.
Indeed.
And Walter, you've been talking to activists all day today and yesterday, people who are in the streets right now. Talk about what this case is and what's the reaction from Pittsburgh.
Right. Well, a demonstration just wrapped up outside of the Allegheny County Courthouse, which is in Pittsburgh itself. East Pittsburgh is technically a different municipality, but of course, the situation, with police brutality, with racism, it's very, very similar, of course. And it is in Allegheny County. And so the decision to charge this police officer rests with the county district attorney, Stephen Zappella, who has held that position since 1998. So there was a big demonstration. Hundreds of people were out there. There were major demonstrations yesterday as well. It's very young. People are, extremely motivated. Antoine Rose, 17 years old. There was another case, although thankfully Jordan Miles was not killed. He was beaten nearly to death. I mean, it was horrific. He was 18 years old. That was several years ago. That was by Pittsburgh City Police. So there's a clear pattern of targeting Black youth here, I think, and the youth of Pittsburgh and the region are responding very strongly.
Walter, talk a little bit about the history of police violence in Pittsburgh. You and I know that over the years, over the decades, it's been an ongoing problem, but I'm sure that most of our listeners, and indeed Americans across the country, really don't know about that history.
Right. The most high-profile police killing, I think, in recent memory in Pittsburgh is probably the murder of Johnny Gamage, who was driving in a white neighborhood. He was pulled over by police officers, and he was killed. He was killed in a traffic stop. And that set off, a wide-ranging movement for a very long time. It led to the creation of a police oversight board in Pittsburgh, although the Civilian Police Review Board was created as a consequence of Johnny Gamage's murder, but the Civilian Police Review Board does not have the ability to hire and fire police officers. It is purely a review board that can just issue reports on the conduct of the police. And so much of the struggle around police brutality in Pittsburgh and the region going forward from that was to give the CPRB more authority, to give the, real people and community control over the police. Jordan Miles was another case that I just mentioned. He was 18 years old. It was, I believe, the day after his 18th birthday. He was walking from his mother's house to his grandmother's house because his grandmother didn't like to stay alone at night. And he was pulled. Well, there were three police officers. They were driving an unmarked car. They were not wearing a uniform. At no point in this confrontation did they identify themselves as police officers. Jordan Miles thought that he was being robbed by three guys who jumped out of a car, but later he found out that they were Pittsburgh police officers, Ewing, Sisak, and Cell Duty, and they beat him so badly that when his mother went to the hospital to try to see who he was, she walked right past him because his face was so disfigured from the beating. And there was a long lasting struggle for years after that. Now we have this latest killing of Antoine Rose by East Pittsburgh police.
So there are demonstrations in Pittsburgh yesterday, today. They seem to be getting bigger. What kind of reforms do you think are possible here? Does the city council, or the county council, I guess, is more appropriate, more accurate. Does the county council intend to take this seriously?
I think it's very important that there are legislative reforms that can be won, concrete legislative reforms that can be won through people's struggle. While the police officers who beat Jordan Miles were not charged criminally, there were series of bills passed by city council that required the Pittsburgh police to record the demographic information of people who they stop. So, you know, it provides some fuel to the fight against racial profiling by the police. But the prosecution of police officers is the ultimate. And Stephen Zappala has consistently refused to prosecute killer and brutal cops throughout his 20-year career.
If cops, like everybody else who murder people, were actually facing life in jail without parole, and that actually happened to some cops, that might make an impact, you know.
That's the most important thing.
Anyway, John Kiriakou, we're out of time. We're going to keep following the Pittsburgh resistance to police murder and police brutality.
We will. That's an important story that we'll stay on top of. We were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Church and State, The Israel Experiment is an upcoming film by Netra Halperin. She's a Hollywood producer and director with a concern for peace and equality. Netra joins us here in the studio to talk about her film. Netra, welcome.
Thank you so much, John. Thanks for having me.
Netra, I watched the trailer to this film. It's very intriguing. It's unlike other films on Gaza and Israel in that it's focused specifically on peace, in addition to other things I'm going to let you talk about in a second. But first of all, what's your personal connection to this issue? Why did this issue concern you?
Well, I grew up with a Jewish father. And we did Passover, we did Hanukkah. And in our Passover ceremonies, we were in this nice middle-class home, and we went to this very pretty wealthy synagogue, and they talked about the slavery of Jews in Egypt. And it seemed totally irrelevant, foreign, not even real. And all that time, I had no idea that the Israeli government, and I want to make sure people are really clear, the Israeli government and Judaism are completely separate things, and people get them combined.
Yes, it's become very political.
Exactly. And yet the Israeli government is perpetrating on the Palestinian people similar conditions of, you know, open-air prison, lack of basic necessities, violence, continuous checkpoints, et cetera, et cetera. And so when I woke up to that, and actually, partly what really helped me is there's a group called Jewish Voice for Peace. And I went to their Passover this spring, and they talked about the oppressions of all people, including Jews, but of all people, and including what Israel is doing to Palestine and other people in this country, et cetera.
And this is a very topical, very important issue. We've been following on this show the demonstrations in Gaza and the Israeli reaction. Do you intend for this film to sort of advance public awareness of what's going on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is absolutely the point of the film, because like I said, in America, the U.S. government, I wouldn't even just say is an ally. I would almost say props up Israel. The U.S. gives $13 million a day to the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, and $3.3 billion a year. And if the United States stopped doing that, things would change. And the reason that they're continuing that and what's happening in Gaza is because Americans, there's not enough outcry. Obviously, there's people who care, but the overall gestalt of the political conversation is not that. There are a few outlier politicians like Bernie Sanders, et cetera, who are saying, whoa, 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 this is not crowd control, just killing people. So the difference that I want to make is public awareness.
There was a piece in the press today saying that in response to the UN General Assembly's vote condemning Israel for its armed reaction to the demonstrations, that the U.S. was going to pull out of the United Nations Human Rights Commission. The vote last week in the General Assembly was something like 120-8. With 45 abstentions. The eight were the United States, Israel, Australia, and then five little tiny microscopic Pacific Island countries. But the United States is so angry about this, having taken a side, the side being that of Israel, that We're actually considering withdrawing from a United Nations body because of it. What would your film tell U.S. policymakers about the situation on the ground there?
Well, that I didn't see that article, but that's really shocking. And yes, I know that the U.S. was trying to block that. I think it would tell U.S. policymakers that that's not acceptable, that America bases its entire raison d'etre, its entire supposed foreign policy, even though, you know, as I think Tillerson said, human rights may be our policy, but it's not our action. And I think more Americans need to know that. And so, yeah, it would tell more Americans that this is a facade and the U.S. needs to put its money where its mouth is. We are not this exceptional people who walk on water. We have to treat our neighbors with dignity, respect, and the right to life. And so I think the thing about Trump is he makes everything more extreme. I mean, there's a couple actually foreign policy things that are that have worked out well with him, but he makes everything extreme. Obama was so eloquent, so well-spoken. The true nature of U.S. foreign policy was obscured because people looked at him as a personality, the cult of the personality in politics. And with Trump, he's so blatant, you know, having Nikki Haley tell the UN, anybody who votes against us on this, we are taking names and we're going to cut off your allowance. And you know, I hope countries take heed of that and start realizing, you know what, we don't have to please the U.S. no matter what it is, especially in human rights issues.
We're speaking with Netra Halperin. She's a director, producer, and writer, and she's talking about her new film, upcoming film, called Church and State, The Israel Experiment. Netra, walk us through the mechanics of how you go about making a film like this. It can't be easy to go to Gaza on the ground and just interview people. That has to be a difficult thing with Israeli oversight as it is. How did you do it, and how do you intend to finish the film?
Well, actually, originally I thought, well, maybe I'll get into Gaza, but then as time has gone on, I've scratched that. So basically, we're going to the West Bank. So there is an organization that I connected with, and they helped me set up interviews throughout the West Bank. And so then I'm going to just go to those interviews, talk to those people. And my original actual profession is psychologist. And so I have a knack of getting information out of people. And so basically I'm going to interview the people that it's on the schedule. And then if I'm walking down the street and I see some kid and he's willing to talk to me, you know, I'll go for that. Because I want to talk to, you know, a young man, 15, 16, and say, you know, what do you think about, fighting back? What do you think, you know, when you hear Hamas, when you hear these names, does that make you think of terrorism? Or does that make you think dignity, manhood, defending my country? You know, what are your options? Do you see this, you know, career path for yourself? Or do you see just dead end nothing? So what are your choices do you see in life? So back to your question. Yeah, it's about, first making the contacts, getting a crew together. We have a film crew from Europe that's going to help us with that. And TV, they're from a TV station. So that's really good. So they're top notch. And then filming it and then, doing minor edits while you go. And then when you get home, you pull it together, add the music, et cetera, and make it a documentary.
And then once it's completed, how are you going to release it? Where will people be able to see it?
Well, probably I'll be working with a professional who does documentary film distribution. And she actually, fortunately, she's already dealt with this issue. So she knows the pitfalls, which people to go to, then there's, of course, there's the usual. There's there's Hulu, there's Amazon, there's Netflix. That's an outlet that's available to small filmmakers that was not available in the past.
So true. You know, I was taking a flight on Alaska Airlines the other day, and they have this, free, whatever it is, TV service. But a lot of it is proprietary channels, and they have the Alaska Airlines documentary channel. And what they do is they show every documentary that had been presented at the most recent Seattle Documentary Film Festival. And I'll tell you what, on a 5-hour flight across the country, I watched like a dozen fantastic short documentaries. These really are available to you now, where even as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, you just wouldn't have even heard about a film like this.
Yeah, and it's the democratization of filmmaking.
It really is.
It's a really great thing because, you know, equipment is cheap. Everything is easier. Everything is easier. And so, yes, there's a panoply of choices, but exactly what you're saying. You know, Alaska Air does that, but then Hulu has Hulu Originals, Netflix Originals. And they're not constrained by the same commercial interests as NBC, CBS, et cetera, et cetera. Yes. They're just really, I'm pretty sure the executives are just thinking, what are people going to watch?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. In addition to all of the film festivals internationally, here and abroad, all over the place, that specialize in new documentaries, whether short or long, and make them available to people who otherwise wouldn't have seen them. So we have about a half a minute left. Tell our listeners where they can view the pre-production teaser and find out more about your film.
Okay, so go to churchandstate.com. So churchandstatedoc.com.
Churchandstatedoc, as in documentary?
Yeah.
.com.
Yes.
Yep. I watched it as soon as you sent it to me a while ago now. I was very intrigued by it. I think once it's finished, it's going to be a very deep and well-done documentary. Good luck and congratulations in advance. We were speaking with Netra Halperin. She's a Hollywood producer, director, and writer with a concern for peace and equality. She joined us here in the studio in Washington to talk about her film, upcoming film, Church and State, The Israel Experiment. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
1 year after Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud was elevated to Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, as well as Defense Minister, his war in Yemen rages on. While MBS, as he's known in the West, maintains an ongoing charm offensive here, his policies threaten the lives of millions of Yemenis, at least 8 million of whom are currently at risk of starvation. And all of this is in the name of curbing Iranian influence in the region. We're joined from Beirut by independent political analyst Marwa Osman. Marwa, welcome back. Marwa, this last year has been very eventful for Mohammed bin Salman, and not necessarily in a good way. He started off by arresting dozens of his friends and cousins and supporters, anybody who might pose a threat to him or to his power and authority. He owns this war in Yemen, and he's been picking at the Iranians, poking the hornet's nest, I guess I could say. How do you view this past year for him?
Well, it was his debut, and it was the year that also where I can say that he burned his image as well. I mean, he debuted with a strong image of him being the man of the iron fist, where he can just arrest all of the royal family, along with businessmen who are multi-billion dollar businessmen who were also arrested in the Ritz-Carlton. And he can also kidnap our prime minister, and France would get involved. And has it not been for Emmanuel Macron, I don't think that we would have seen our prime minister again. And then he raised the dangerous risks of continuation of the blockade and the war, the aggression against the people of Yemen. And as you were just saying, more than 8 million Yemenis are on the brink of starvation because of that. And now, in these past 2 weeks, ever since the last week of Ramadan, up until now, it has been crazy in Hodeidah. Hodeidah is one of the districts in and the cities of Yemen, and it's a coastal city. So they are trying to take Hodeidah as well, but it has cost them a lot, and they have bombed a lot of civilians in their way as well. And let us not forget the Mohammed bin Salman's infamous deal of the century, where he's trying to literally sell Palestine to the Zionists in return, and for the Americans in return for him keeping his power. We have seen a lot of attempts of him, from him against Qatar, for example. What he did, up until now, the Qatari situation, the Qatari crisis with the rest of the Gulf countries is still unresolved, and I don't think it's going to be resolved anytime soon. We have seen more wreaking havoc in Libya, where he recently, just less than a month ago, he made he visited the area, and he sat with one of the, let's say, his men in Libya as well. He's making sure everything's going as needed. He also sat, and that was a huge shock for everyone. He did a meeting. He sat with Muqtada Sadr, the Iraqi politician, the very famous Iraqi politician whose alliance won in the he won the majority in the Iraqi parliament just approximately a month ago. And then he sat with him, and he's a huge Shia cleric. So he's trying to break the Shias, if you will. And we could move down a bit towards Jordan. Just less than 3 weeks ago, we saw what was happening in Jordan, some sort of a revolution. The people were in the streets. It was the government was downed, and it was about to be, the scene was about to be similar to what was going on in Syria up until the King of Jordan decided to submit and be part of the coalition of Mohammed bin Salman. He went to Saudi Arabia. He sat with him. They talked it over, which means he complied with what Mohammed bin Salman wants. So basically, he's been trying his best to be the leader, quote unquote, of the Middle Eastern region by him telling people what to do according to his demands. But at the same time, he has been losing in Syria, and he has been losing in Yemen, relatively speaking, because he's still bombing civilians. But on the ground, invasion-wise, it's not been going well for him. We've had lists of commanders, Emirati and Saudi commanders, who have been killed just this week in Hodeidah. So it's been going terrible for them. And at the same time, in the northern part of Yemen, they have been losing grounds. I mean, the northern borderline with the southern borderline of Saudi Arabia with Yemen is being retaken. It's not actually being occupied by Yemen, because historically it's Yemeni land. So they are retaking their land. So Mohammed bin Salman is losing land to the southern part of his border. So it's been chaotic, I can tell you. But the top notch, which is a detail, but it's a very important detail about Mohammed bin Salman, is his a deep relationship that he was able to create with Trump and Kushner in specific. So he basically is running the show in the Middle East right now, but with the acceptance and the approval of Trump.
Marwa Osman is our guest. We're talking to her from Lebanon. We're talking about this is the 1 year anniversary of the taking of power for Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. I want to go take some time to really help Americans here who are getting their media or their information from the corporate owned media, and they don't really know anything about Yemen and what the situation actually is in Yemen. It seems to me that this is of critical importance. And if you wouldn't mind just explaining what the horrors are in Yemen for the people, and what's the solution?
Well, I've written a lot of pieces about Yemen. They could search for that under my name, and they could find it. At first, they could find a lot of my articles about Yemen, where I speak in details about the numbers, the atrocities, the cholera, the diphtheria, all of these issues in the border blockade. And just today, I published also a piece about Hodeidah. For those who don't know what's going on in Hodeidah, there's a quadruple attack against Hodeidah issued by the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, U.S., and France. And I'm talking about French troops who are now detained by the Yemeni resistance. I repeat, French nationals who are French troops that are in the French army that are detained by the Yemeni forces in Hodeidah. They have to read about this massive amount of information, because this war has been waged without the consent of the people, whether in the U.S. or in France, for that matter. That's to begin with. But to talk more about Yemen, first of all, Yemen is it is the poorest Arab country to begin with, even before the war started on March 15th, 2015. It was the poorest country in the Arab world. They had a lot of illiteracy. They had a lot of child deaths. They had a lot of child marriages. It was catastrophic to begin with as a community. But before the war started, there was some sort of political concession that was being prepared. It's a dialogue that was very fruitful, very successful. And there was a six-point convention that was supposed to be abided by the government with the Southerners and the Northerners. The Northerners are what is known by the mainstream media as the Houthis, but it's actually Ansarullah, because Ansarullah is the name of the party that actually involves hundreds of tribes. Houthis are just one tribe out of these hundreds of tribes that are part of Ansarullah. And the Southerners are those who part of the former President Hadi, Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, and also the former Al-Ahmar leader, his name is Al-Ahmar, and also are the followers of the former late president Ali Abdullah Saleh. So there was a consensus, there was a dialogue going on. It was very fruitful. I mean, the week that this dialogue was supposed to be signed and made into a law for the government to have a new formed unity government for the entire country, the war started because Saudi Arabia didn't want that to happen, and Saudi Arabia saw Yemen as its own backyard, and they wanted to put their hands on, first of all, the resources, second of all, the entrances to the ocean, because we all know how strategic, it's strategically important the location of Yemen is. So that started the war. The war has been going on for 3.5 years. Throughout that war, it's been a blockade, aerial, naval, and land blockade against the people. No food, no medication has been going on. That you could read about the UN reports. All the reports are online. It's catastrophic.
What's happening to the people in Yemen, John, is one of the great, great crimes of this era.
And I think the United Nations is going to have to take a look at this with an eye toward war crimes and crimes against humanity. But we're out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us at Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. And you can hear us at SputnikNews.com, as a podcast at iTunes, and now as a podcast at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.